This is Roland, your volunteer reader at Sun Sounds of Arizona, with today's reading of the Arizona Daily Star. On the front page, firms cash in on teacher shortage. Just before Sadie Shaw's daughter started her first day at Dodge Traditional Middle Magnet School in Tucson last year, her daughter's math teacher abruptly resigned. A long-term substitute stepped in, then another. A math teacher from the grade above coached the subs as they rotated through. Shaw has another vested interest in solving the teacher shortage in the Tucson Unified School District. She sits on its governing board. Her daughter's teacher left the district before the start of the 2025-26 school year. At least 8,523 educators exited Arizona's public schools between the last two academic years. That's a loss nearly three times greater than the number of new teachers certified to replace them. To keep classrooms staffed, districts across Arizona are signing contracts with private staffing companies and paying invoices in taxpayer dollars. The arrangement is used nationally. It keeps schools open and teachers in the classroom. But it also raises a difficult question. As private companies generating billions in revenue nationally move into a captive market, how much of that public money actually makes it to the educators standing in front of Arizona students? An investigation by the Beam and Cronkite News found the teacher and staffing shortage in Arizona has attracted investors who found a valuable market. Cash-strapped districts pay top dollar to fill gaps with teachers, psychologists, therapists, and other specialist schools can no longer recruit on their own. The result? Public money meant to reach students is flowing to private staffing companies that report billions in annual revenue. Arizona school districts are paying private companies nearly $80,000 per teacher per year in taxpayer dollars, and often have no idea how much of that money reaches the teacher. The company supplying teachers to nearly a quarter of Arizona's public schools is tied to a multi-billion dollar staffing empire founded by the majority owner of the Baltimore Ravens. Arizona districts are relying on alternative staffing to mitigate the shortage. Rising visa costs for international teachers who fill some staffing gaps for Arizona schools could make shortages worse and push districts to rely more heavily on staffing companies. Arizona public schools began the 2025-26 year short on teachers, and not by a small margin. In October 2025, the Arizona Department of Education, ADE, reported 4,379 vacancies across all counties, with school districts in Maricopa County accounting for the largest share at 2,500 vacancies. Superintendent Tom Horn said the teacher shortage at the beginning of the 2025-26 school year remained in a catastrophic state. The problem did not arrive overnight. Many districts began recruiting 6 months before the start of the school year, but they still had to rely on contracted agency or vendor personnel to fill at least 731 full-time equivalent positions because traditional hiring methods were not enough, according to the ADE. Those vacancies are fed, in part, by a documented problem with retaining public school teachers. Between the last two school years, nearly one in five Arizona teachers either left the profession or moved to a different local education agency. A total of 8,523 teachers, 14% of the workforce, exited Arizona public schools entirely in a single year. When traditional hiring fails, the district turns to private staffing agencies and international hires to place qualified teachers in classrooms. Tucson Unified School District, TUSD, knows the cycle well. The district has, for years, faced a shortage of teachers, with middle and high school math positions among the hardest to staff. The district prioritizes employing long-term substitute teachers and internal staff before seeking a contracted teacher, but it often struggles to provide consistent and highly qualified personnel for its students. It's not a question of subs not taking these jobs. They're taking them on a daily basis, weekly basis, on a multi-day basis, Superintendent Gabriel Trujillo of TUSD said during a school board meeting held in September 24, 2024. That is not what the students need. They need a full-time, highly qualified teacher to take it for the year. The district employed 6 contracted general education teachers for the 2024-25 school year, a number that doubled for the 2025-26 school year. Shaw, who has served on the governing board since January 2021, is an outspoken critic of the district's growing reliance on contracted teachers. "I feel like we vote on this almost every board meeting," she said during a TUSD governing board meeting in August 2022. "We keep kicking the can down the road by getting these contracted teachers." In 2026, her position on contracted general education teachers has not changed. "It's either we hire a contracted teacher who does get paid slightly more than our regular teachers do, or we subject the students to a long-term substitute who may not be as qualified as the contracted teachers would be," she said. "So unfortunately, it's a necessary evil that TUSD and other school districts have to grapple with because there's a teacher shortage nationwide. I still think we're kicking the can down the road," she said. TUSD is far from alone in turning to outside vendors, and the companies supplying those teachers have taken notice. Several healthcare staffing companies have expanded their business models to provide school districts with teachers, a transition made easier as schools' need for special education teachers, speech therapists, and behavioral specialists overlapped with the services they already provided. Districts are already spending heavily to keep classrooms staffed, but the costs may soon climb further. Many areas have often relied on teachers recruited from overseas to fill vacancies, but changes to the H-1B visa process under President Donald Trump threaten this tenuous system. Without the stopgap measure to slow the shortage, contracted teachers could be one of the few options public schools have left. Devastating cuts threaten Arizona. A federal plan could nearly double proposed Colorado River cuts. The federal government is likely to accept the proposal from California, Arizona, and Nevada for some cuts to their river water supplies, an Arizona state official said Monday. But the official said he's also concerned the feds will call for a much bigger cut on top of that, a cut that would slash river water use in those 3 lower Colorado River Basin states by nearly twice as much as they're proposing. "Such a cut would be devastating in Arizona," he said, speaking on condition his name and title not be used. "Not only would the larger potential cut burn through the entire supply of the Central Arizona project that serves drinking water to Tucson and Phoenix, but it could also cut river water supplies to the agricultural stronghold of Yuma and water now used by riverfront communities such as Lake Havasu City and Bullhead City," he said. The U.S. Bureau of Reclamation's final record of decision for the Colorado River is due Friday, said the state official, who also expects the Bureau to release its final environmental impact statement on the river this week. Bureau spokesman Peter Soth didn't respond to a question from the Star seeking to confirm the release date. The Lower Basin proposal, publicly released in May, called on California, Arizona, and Nevada to cut their river water use by a total of 1.25 million acre-feet a year, or a little more than 10 years' worth of Tucson Water's annual drinking water deliveries to its customers. Arizona would take 760,000 acre-feet a year of those cuts under the Lower Basin state's proposal. The proposal also called for an additional 700,000 acre-feet cut to be spread among the 3 states. Late last week, the Los Angeles Times reported, and the Star confirmed, that Arizona would take a 31% cut in its total Colorado River water supply in the first round of federal cuts. A 31% cut of Arizona's total 2.8 million acre-foot Colorado River allocation would amount to about 868,000 acre-feet. Another concern expressed by the Arizona official is that the Bureau's final decision will not require any mandatory cuts on the part of the upper basin states of Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming. The Bureau's draft statement didn't require such cuts. Many observers say they believe the Bureau is concerned it lacks the legal authority to order such cuts when its authority to order cuts in the lower basin is clear. The official noted that the Bureau has also released to the states a potential preferred alternative for the river that would allow it to cut lower basin water use by a total of 3 million acre-feet a year. Many outside scientists have said a larger cut might or will be needed. At Monday's briefing, the state official said, I would hope to see in the final EIS some computer modeling analysis that would show how the three lower basin states plan would perform in relation to different hydrological scenarios for how much money comes, for how much water comes down the river each year. This will give you some idea about whether we may need more cuts as you project elevations in Lake Mead, the Arizona official said. We will be consulting with the federal government and all seven basin states to look at all the actions that might take place to further protect Lake Mead and Lake Powell, and that would be the path forward. But if there is a 3 million acre foot a year cut and the cuts on lower basin water users are made based on their legal priority rights to river water, not only does it burn through all of the cap water, it starts to impact higher priority users within my state, my folks on the river in the Yuma area, the official said. Can't tell you how much it would affect them. It would start to impact California, mostly metropolitan, also priority users along the river in this state, Bullhead City, Lake Havasu. These are devastating potential impacts. Tucson and region. Building climbs bolt by bolt. Aaron Collins loves to see people on the bolted rock climbing routes he puts up in the mountain cliffs of central Arizona. He's one of a few dozen experts who have combined to create thousands of vertical trails in Arizona of varying difficulty. Once established, untold numbers of rock climbers go on to enjoy the routes for years, if not decades. The developers, as they're called, might spend $100 or more of their own money on the stainless steel bolts installed on each route and create 100 or more routes over time. Most do it for the love of the sport. Collins, a 49-year-old Iraq combat veteran and professional mountain guide from Mesa, spends a few thousand bucks a year on route creation. Developers are kind of funny climbers because we love climbing, but we love putting up our routes, he said. We don't have time to climb other people's routes, you know what I mean? Because I got too many projects. He considers himself an artist and said what drives him to build new routes is the imagination, the vision of it. I see a wall. I say, that'll go, he said. On a relatively cool day on May 8th, in an ethereal canyon in the Christopher Creek area near Payson, Collins installed 9 bolts into a crag to make a new route. He was rewarded the same day by the sight of climbers clipping onto his bolt hangers as they ascended his creation. When Collins started rock climbing as a teenager, he coveted the life of dirtbag climbers who live out of their SUVs with no paying job, traveling from one climbing spot to another. Responsibilities got in the way, he said. I always thought route development was super sacred or you had to be some badass to do it, he said. The first route Collins established contained only 3 bolts. He said the route, which is called AAA, is still one of the coolest lines I put up. He met other first ascensionists and learned how to identify good lines and 5-star route making. Collins found his calling when working for a climbing guide company in Utah. He joined the American Mountain Guides Association and in 2015 opened his own business, Arizona Mountain Guides. Climbing has exploded in popularity in recent years, becoming an Olympic sport and inspiring up to 10 million Americans to climb at least occasionally. Mountainous Arizona is a haven for local climbers and visitors from around the world. Top roping, the style for climbing high routes most seen at gyms, is the safest way to climb a route like those Collins creates. A harnessed climber is attached to one end of the rope, which runs to an anchor at the top and back down to a belayer. The influx of newer sport climbing routes of the past few decades reflects a more safety-conscious mindset, though it has also come with ethical considerations and harsh criticism that includes chopping someone else's bolts off the rock. In that style of the sport, the climber ascends with double-sided carabiners known as quick draws that clip into the bolts that Collins and his colleagues drill into the rock face. Not every route has bolts. In traditional or trad climbing, for protection, the climber uses removable gear like spring-loaded camming devices placed into crevices in the rock instead of bolts. The belayer in both trad and sport climbing still stops the rope when the lead climbers fall, but lead climbers drop more than twice the distance they are above their protection. On the day the Arizona Republic observed, Collins rappelled down a route and used climbing chalk to draw little X's on the cliff face where he thought bolts should go, first tapping the rock surface with his hammer. A ringing sound means a good spot to sink a bolt. A hollow sound means the rock's likely brittle. A fairly straight plumb line for the bolts is ideal to prevent rope drag that could vex a lead climber. His battery-powered Bosch drill made the hole for one of the expansion bolts, fitted with a bolt hanger, which he hammered home. Using a small tube he's wrapped around his neck while hanging on rappel, he blew away the light-colored dust from the drilling. "I typically do two or three in a row," Collins said of the routes he makes. "If I was to come into here and put up one route, like, so what? But if you, it's like coming in and doing 10 or something, you're contributing." The Payson area Canyon Collins and others are developing is on Tonto National Forest land, but not in a wilderness area. He knows some officials don't like the land to change at all, but with no ban on it, I don't have to ask for permission. Court clears the way for new DEI measure. There's nothing illegal about asking Arizonans to approve a new set of constitutional amendments designed to prevent discrimination and preferential treatment, a judge has ruled. Maricopa County Superior Court Judge Julianne Marta acknowledged that Proposition 142 would make a number of changes in existing constitutional provisions. These change from how public funds can be used at public universities to banning disciplinary policies that treat students differently based on race or ethnicity. There's also wording in the ballot measure that says public entities, not just universities, could not compel applicants, employees, or students to support preferential treatment as a condition of admission, graduation, employment, contracting, or scholarships. But Marta rejected arguments by a group known as Will of the People that the provisions are sufficiently different that they violate the separate amendment rule of the Arizona Constitution and that it's illegal to ask voters to adopt them as a single measure. The judge also said claims that Prop 142 would run afoul of First Amendment protections of free speech are legally irrelevant, at least at this point, to whether voters should be given a chance to decide the issues in the November election. Marta said that this is a question that would have to be addressed only if and when the measure is approved. There was no immediate response from challengers on the question of whether or not there would be an appeal. Hobbs and Biggs must pick their number twos. Political insiders have been speculating for months about an upcoming Arizona first. Who will be the state's lieutenant governor? With the race for governor set as a battle between Democrat Katie Hobbs and Republican Andy Biggs, that conjecture might crescendo. Hobbs and Biggs face a deadline to pick their number twos, one of whom will become the state's first lieutenant governor in Arizona's 114 years of statehood. Neither Biggs nor Hobbs' campaign has so much as hinted publicly at who their candidate might pick to join the ticket, adding another mystery to the race to November. Here's what you need to know about the state's first election for lieutenant governor. Arizonans voted in favor of creating the job in 2022, passing what was called Proposition 131 by a 10 percentage point margin. A bipartisan blend of Arizona lawmakers sent the question to the ballot that year, when the third time proved the charm. There have been several prior attempts to add the position and change the line of succession that was established in the Arizona Constitution, but voters rejected similar ballot measures in 1994 and 2010. A law passed in 2022 before Arizonans passed the proposition to set a framework for how the lieutenant would run for office and the job's duties. The law signed by then-Governor Doug Ducey says the gubernatorial nominees must choose the person who will appear with them on the ballot not later than 60 days before the general election. This year's general election is November 3, meaning an early September deadline for Hobbs and Biggs to choose. The lieutenant governor replaces the secretary of state as the person who succeeds the governor if the governor can't do the job for some reason. The elected secretary of state had been second in line to the governor since statehood in 1912. The lieutenant governor will have a day job, too. The governor can appoint their lieutenant to lead the Department of Administration, to serve as their chief of staff, or to another position under the governor's authority, which opens the door to a range of positions when it comes to power and profile. Supporters of the new position said consistency for voters was a reason to create the new position, even despite Arizona's history of tending to favor smaller government bureaucracy. Twice before, the old line of succession meant secretaries of state succeeded governors of the opposing political party. After Republican Governor Evan Meacham was impeached in 1988, Democratic Secretary of State Rose Mofford took over, and after Democrat Janet Napolitano left office in 2009 to join the Obama administration, Republican Secretary of State Jan Brewer became governor. Arizona joins the majority of states which have a lieutenant governor position. According to the Council of State Governments, just Maine, New Hampshire, Oregon, and Wyoming do not have a lieutenant governor. The effectiveness of those office holders in other states has, at times, been publicly pilloried. Alabama's lieutenant governor has minimal power, but still 9 candidates want the job this year, the Alabama Reflector reported in May. California's lieutenant governor, a stepping stone job previously held by current governor Gavin Newsom, is largely ceremonial and perceived by the public as a job about nothing, according to the news organization CalMatters. Guthrie begs for her mom's return. As the 6-month anniversary of her mother's disappearance approached, Savannah Guthrie posted another plea for information as to her whereabouts, saying, "Help us bring the situation to an end. The family has been in agony since Nancy Guthrie went missing," the Today Show host said in a video posted to Instagram. "I'm coming on today with a very specific message," Guthrie begins the video. "It has been months since our mom was taken from us. Our family is in agony. We are in a nightmare that will not end. Nothing about our situation has changed. And we have done our part. We will never stop looking for her. We will always ache for her and feel that hole in our hearts." Savannah Guthrie then made a direct plea to anyone who may have been involved in her mother's disappearance. "The world can be a cruel and unforgiving place, and I know you have tried to do things the right way, so I'm asking you, begging you, to do the right thing now. Make the right choice. Help us find her. Tell us where to look for her. I truly believe it's never too late to do the right thing. Help us bring this situation to an end, for all of us. No matter where we've been or what we've done, I believe there's always a way home. Please make the right choice." Nancy Guthrie was reported missing from her home in the Catalina Foothills neighborhood north of Tucson on February 1st after she did not show up at a friend's home to watch a virtual church service. Neither the Pima County Sheriff's Department nor the FBI have publicly identified a suspect in Guthrie's abduction since receiving tens of thousands of leads. And in business, Cracker Barrel CEO resigns. Cracker Barrel CEO is stepping down a year after a controversial logo change received backlash. The company announced on July 27 that Julie Messino will step down and be replaced by David Deneau as the next chief executive officer. Deneau most recently was CEO of Bloomin' Brands, the owner of casual restaurant chains such as Outback Steakhouse, Carrabba's Italian Grill, and Bonefish Grill. The change takes effect August 19, a news release said. "Following a robust and thoughtful search process, we are pleased to welcome David as Cracker Barrel's next CEO," independent chairman of the Cracker Barrel board, Carl Berquist, said. "He brings decades of experience across the restaurant and retail industries with a strong track record of leading businesses through growth and a demonstrated commitment to operational excellence, guest experience, and team member engagement." Messina was named CEO for Cracker Barrel in July 2023. In August 2025, Cracker Barrel announced it was rebranding, which included removing from its logo a man seated next to a wooden barrel. The restaurant named him in the statement as Uncle Herschel, the uncle of Cracker Barrel founder Dan Evans. The restaurant chain and country store then responded to backlash over the simplification of its logo. If the last few days have shown us anything, it's how deeply people care about Cracker Barrel. We're truly grateful for your heartfelt voices," the company said in a statement on August 25, 2025. "You've also shown us that we could have done a better job sharing who we are and who we'll always be." Cracker Barrel fans took to social media to share their opinion on its new logo, with some calling on the chain to change it back. The new rebrand took the feeling away, one person wrote on Cracker Barrel's Instagram, cold and sterile. States expose Medicaid employers. As the Trump administration's January deadline looms for states to enforce new Medicaid work requirements, some state lawmakers seek to publicly name the largest companies that have employees enrolled in the government program covering low-income and disabled people. California lawmakers seek to revive an expired law that would require the state to identify companies that employ 100 or more people and have employees enrolled in Medi-Cal, the state's Medicaid program. Nevada had a similar law in place since 2017. A proposal for one in Oregon stalled. The California bill author, Democratic State Senator Lola Smallwood Cuevas, said she is deeply troubled by what will happen when work requirements kick in. According to the state, almost 5 million out of more than 14 million residents on Medi-Cal would be subject to the rule. "We think this is a bill that's about fairness," she said. "It's a basic principle that taxpayers deserve transparency about which large employers are shifting their health care costs onto the public." Large employers that top Nevada's list, such as Walmart and Amazon, said the state included part-time and seasonal workers in their counts, and their full-time hourly employees make too much to qualify for Medicaid. Walmart spokesman Katrina Proffitt said the company offers affordable medical coverage to most employees, including eligible part-time workers, and most of its plan include no-cost virtual care options. Healthcare affordability and access to quality care remains real barriers for many Americans, and Walmart continues to be committed to being part of the solution, Proffitt said. The push to name and shame companies reflects dueling narratives about the biggest abuses of the joint state-federal Medicaid program, which reached almost $932 billion in government spending in 2024. The Trump administration, led by Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Administrator Mehmet Oz, called out blue states for not doing enough to fight insurer fraud and abuse. State Democratic leaders, meanwhile, called attention to big employers that don't offer affordable health benefits, which leads taxpayers subsidizing health care costs for the low-wage workforce. Democratic New Jersey Governor Mikey Sherrill signed a bill in June to fine businesses that have at least 50 Medicaid-enrolled employees. Companies with 50 to 249 workers on Medicaid will pay $325 a year per person, and those with at least 500 will pay $725. Similar bills failed in Washington State and Colorado this year. In California, Democrats want to figure out a way to make large businesses pay for their employees' health coverage. State lawmakers struck a deal with Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom to explore tax options. States face losing billions of dollars under the GOP tax cuts and spending law known as the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, notably through a provision that requires non-disabled Medicaid enrollees aged 19 to 64 in most states to prove they work, volunteer, or go to school at least 80 hours a month to keep their coverage. Federal work requirements are projected to increase the number of uninsured people nationwide by more than 5 million by 2034, according to the Congressional Budget Office. Early retirees wished they'd saved more. Americans are retiring sooner than they expect, and most retirees wish they had done a better job saving. Those are the conclusions of a new report from TIAA Institute, a research arm of the retirement services provider. The findings are probably related, TIAA leaders say. Workers who retire early have less time to save, and their savings must cover a longer retirement. Roughly three-quarters of retirees surveyed said they regret not saving earlier in their lives. Nearly three-quarters said they wished they had saved more. "People are expressing regret," said Surya Kaluri, head of TIAA Institute. "That's a powerful emotion. We can take that emotion and apply it to people who have not left the workforce." The new report, Bridging the Gaps in Retirement Expectations, joins a larger body of research that shows American workers tend to retire before they planned and before they are ready. In the TIAA Institute survey, released Wednesday, The average retiree said they retired at age 57. Of those retirees, 52% said they retired earlier than expected, while only 6% said they retired later than planned. The average working American in the survey, by contrast, said they expect to retire 5 years later at 62. The survey reached 1,591 adults aged 22 to 75. Earlier studies consistently found that American workers retire before they planned. Most workers don't plan to retire that early. According to the latest EBRI survey, the average worker expects to retire at 65. According to Transamerica, 39% of workers plan to retire after 70, if at all. Workers often map out retirement plans around two or three milestone ages. One is 65 when Medicare becomes available. Another is 62 when most retirees become eligible for Social Security. A third is 67, which Social Security regards as full retirement age for most workers. And that brings us to just after 12:30 this afternoon. Fortunately, I have retired, and that means that I'm here to read the newspaper for you today. In the opinion section, it's letters from the editor again. We started it. There was a great deal of criticism about the initial peace framework made with Iran. Yes, Iran asked for what they wanted. These critics complained that it was not good for the United States. What did they expect? We bombed Iran with no provocation. We killed children and innocent people. No reason was given to Iran, the international community, or the people of the United States. We broke international law, not only by bombing Iran, but also by blasting boats out of international water, invading Venezuela, and stealing its oil. We are swaggering around because Trump says we can. The whole world knows what we did. The U.S. was wrong. We should pay. Pay up and get out. If people think that there is some dignified way of ending this, look how long the U.S. was looking for that and delaying getting out of Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq. There is no winning here. We lost when the first bomb fell. Barbara Moore, Eastside. Star misses best sports story. I subscribe to the Star because I like following the local angle that it often covers. However, the Star completely ignored one of the best Tucson sports stories of the year. An athlete born in Tucson, a product of Tucson preschools, elementary, middle, and high schools, just competed in what could be argued as the most difficult sporting events in the world. And he did incredibly well. On Sunday, the 25-year-old native Tucsonan Matthew Riccitiello finished the 2063-mile Tour de France. This first-year TDF rider supported his team, went on breakaways, and helped pull his team leader up countless mountain passes. Of the 184 riders who started this year's tour, Riccitiello rode to a 24th place finish. This is an incredible story about a native Tucsonan performing remarkably on a global stage, yet there was zero ink devoted to it in the local Tucson newspaper. Come on, you can do better. Todd Brown, Midtown. Couching viable gun law. Many events require inspection before entering a stadium or theater. Why can't Tucson declare that an event is taking place within a certain perimeter, including a number of streets where automobile traffic is disallowed, and inspect the public as it enters? Clientele would thus be assured that during specified hours, no drunkard within that perimeter could start shooting. I can see there are problems with this, but maybe solutions too. Peter Harley, Midtown. Out to Sonnen in the Tour. This year's Tour de France race, which has just ended, drew somewhere between 12 and 15 million roadside spectators and somewhere over 3 billion television and online viewers. That is a huge global audience for this once-a-year event. This year, there was a native Tucsonan, Matthew Riccitiello, who was racing against the very best riders in the world. Out of 184 riders who started the race, Matthew came in 24th. That is an astounding accomplishment, especially for this three-week event that many people consider to be the most difficult Tour de France ever. In a media news world dominated by the horrible things we do to each other and the world, I'd like to hear more about people in our community that we should be proud of. Ivan Newcomb, Southeast Side. Pima County Voter Confidence. Voters in Pima County should have complete confidence in how our votes are processed and tabulated. This year, I volunteered to be an early ballot election observer and was impressed by the professionalism of our election workers. The counting of ballots, opening of affidavit envelopes, and preparing ballots for machine tabulation is a secure, well-organized, nonpartisan process. I also participated as a hand count auditor. Volunteers from all parties worked collaboratively to ensure that a sampling of ballots read by tabulation machines was accurate. At my table, they were 100%. Pima County election workers and volunteers are committed to fair elections in order to protect and preserve our right to vote, a cornerstone of democracy. If you have any doubts, please volunteer to observe or participate in an audit. I guarantee you will come away with a profound sense of gratitude for and renewed trust in our electoral process. Judy Morellon, Northeast Side. Courageous humans. A letter writer is worried that now that the closet doors are open, my description, same-sex marriage has become mainstream. I'm a lesbian who's married. There are more abortions and transsexuality will increase dramatically in 50 years. Oh my. His concern is the bathroom and his granddaughters, even though it goes without saying that we've all been sharing our private spaces with transgender people for a very long time. Transgender people are courageous humans who choose to live in wholeness and honesty despite the judgment and ignorance of those few who can't mind their own business. And of course the transgender threat is an obvious political ploy by those in government involved in corruption, greed, and power. They want us focused on the gay agenda, or now, the transgender ideology, instead of a failed, corrupt presidency, which is a serious threat to our democracy. Karen Allison, 3 points. Abandoned ship. In the Sam Levitt's parking lot, Orange Grove and Thornydale, someone abandoned a 20-foot boat. No trailer, no motor, poor condition. What was the purpose of the abandonment? Was this artwork provided to the city of Marana? Was there too much rain in Tucson, southern Arizona, causing it to float from Rocky Point? Was it time to abandon ship with all hope lost? Did the price of groceries go so high that the person had to decide which was more important, the boat or the kids? The boat seems abandoned for some time because no one was showing any concern. Was this a sign of the times when an abandoned boat in a parking lot is viewed as a common occurrence in America? Hemingway's Old Man and the Sea describes an old fisherman catching a prized swordfish. Then sharks began to attack. Perhaps a sharknado dust devil dropped the boat in the parking lot. What was the reason? Ray Bynum, Northwest Side. Make Trump pay for his vanity. Illegal. No matter how Trump packs boards, staff, or committee with puppets, Trump took about 80% of National Park Service funds for illegal vanity projects. Congress must pass a law forcing Trump to pay personally for them via corrupt profits accumulated while in office. Bills to date, including planning costs, I include ballroom and basement, $600 million, reflecting pool and nine others, plus fencing, $60.04 million, July 4, $90 million, arch estimates, $100 million, Kennedy Center overhauls and signage, $257 million, banners, $1.1 million, golf course, $400 million, and federal building paint, $7.5 million. Not bringing back lives lost in national parks from lack of help, 3 to date in the Grand Canyon. NPS backlog damages, $35 billion. Vanity bills total $2,114,640,000,000. Did we have a say? Nope. Trump saves money firing 200,000 federal employees. Trump has made $2.2 billion in office. Perfect. Project waste was our money. Vote in November and make Congress work for people, not bow to a psychopath. Nancy Jacques, Northeast Side. Headlines. Read June 27, article Many Americans Against Trump's DC Projects. If you read the article reprinted from US Today Network, you learn that 65% of those polled were either upset or dissatisfied with the projects, while 32% were enthusiastic about them. Later in the article, we learn that a whopping 99% of comments submitted to the National Capital Planning Commission about Trump's arch between Arlington National Cemetery and the Lincoln Memorial criticized the project, and only 26% of people polled believe Trump wants to make Washington beautiful. 42% of those asked by the Post opined Trump was trying to glorify himself, and another 22% felt he was trying to leave his mark. In my opinion, 32% qualifies as many, and 65% and 99% qualify as most. Both words are four letters. Since space wasn't an issue, the headline should accurately reflect the polls. Please stop sane-washing Trump. James Birchall, Eastside. Data center rules. I've helped develop data center zoning regulations and learned that communities need rules before approving projects, not after. The proposed La Osa Energy Center and Project Midway would bring large-scale data center campuses, power plants, battery storage, and transmission infrastructure to South Central Pinal County, including areas along Ironwood Forest National Monument and the Greater Santa Cruz River Corridor. In the last Pinal County Planning and Zoning Commission meeting, commissioners asked whether the county was developing data center regulations. Staff's response was ambiguous, even as these projects move forward. A county ordinance should establish standards for appropriate locations, setbacks, water and energy use, wildlife connectivity, lighting, noise, cumulative impacts, public review, and decommissioning. Pinal County should adopt those standards before granting approval to these projects. Doing so isn't anti-development, it's good planning. Clear rules protect residents, natural resources, and developers alike by creating predictable expectations before the landscape is permanently changed. Nick Mayer, Foothills. In national and world news, a Japanese mayor is the first to take maternity leave. With no formal guidelines in place, the move sparked attention. The mayor of a small Japanese city became the first sitting mayor in the country to take maternity leave this month, a decision that has drawn some criticism at home and attracted international media attention. Shoko Kawata, mayor of Yawata, a city of around 69,000 people in western Japan, said she had planned to have children when she became Japan's youngest female mayor in 2023 at the age of 33. However, while 16 weeks of maternity leave are guaranteed for Yawata city employees, no such protocol existed for the mayoral position, she said, forcing her to create one. I was very surprised myself to learn that I am the first mayor to take maternity leave. It made me realize that until now there simply haven't been many young women, or women in general, who have become mayors, Kawata said. One of her last public duties before going on maternity leave came July 17, when she took part in a street procession ahead of Yawata's Taiko Festival. But rather than riding on top of the Mikoshi, or portable Shinto shrine, as tradition dictates, the heavily pregnant Kawata walked behind it. While Sanae Takaichi became Japan's first female prime minister last year, the country's yawning gender gap is particularly prevalent in its male-dominated politics. Japan ranked 118 out of 148 countries in the World Economic Forum's most recent gender gap report, and was 125th in the political empowerment category. Kawata said significant room for reform remains, especially if the aging country is going to try to improve one of the lowest birth rates in the world. Japanese women are legally entitled to claim around 14 weeks of maternity leave and are typically paid about two-thirds of their wages and a birth bonus, though some government workers receive better terms. People talk about gender equality and work style reform, but we need to build a society in which people across all professions, including among those in leadership roles, do not hesitate to have children. Otherwise, I believe continual population decline resulting from falling birth rates and the resulting economic deterioration are inevitable, she said. Kawata said most local residents supported her and colleagues encouraged her to take the leave, but she was disappointed by some online criticism that came with the extensive media coverage of her leave. Her baby is due in September. People who have never heard of me before only learned about me through reports focused on the maternity leave. Some people criticized me online, suggesting that I wasn't doing my job and was just there to take maternity leave. That was disappointing, she said. Most Yawata residents interviewed by Reuters said they supported Kawata's decision, but some, including local resident and homemaker Chai Fujita, took issue with the mayor receiving her full salary while on leave. I'm a woman, and I've given birth myself, so I believe that, as a woman's right, she should be able to take time off when giving birth. However, regarding her salary, I don't really agree with her receiving 100% with it while she's on leave, Fujita said. The U.S. tests GMO flies to fight flesh-eating livestock pest. A U.S.-funded facility in Panama, scientists are preparing to launch the first outdoor tests of genetically modified screwworm flies, a milestone in efforts to develop a more effective weapon against the flesh-eating parasite that spread through Central America and into the United States. Researchers said they will keep the flies confined in mesh cages exposed to Panama's heat and humidity to measure how long they survive outside laboratory conditions before later stages of field testing. The Trump administration touted the development of the genetically modified fly, called NovaFly, as a game-changer in the fight against New World screwworm. Widespread infestations could cause the estimated losses of more than $1 billion to Texas's livestock industry and spread to other U.S. states. Screwworm are parasitic flies whose females lay eggs in open wounds and mucous membranes on warm-blooded animals. Once the eggs hatch, the screwworm larvae use their sharp mouths to burrow through living flesh, eventually killing their host if left untreated. For decades, the most effective tool against them was widespread dispersal of sterile screwworm flies, which are now mostly produced at the Panama facility. The U.S. Department of Agriculture and Panama's Ministry of Agricultural Development jointly manage and finance the plant that produces about 100 million sterile flies per week. Opened in 2006 on the narrow isthmus, the plant was intended to maintain a barrier to stop wild screwworm flies from spreading into Central America and North America. Now wild screwworm flies spread throughout Mexico and in June infested livestock in Texas for the first time in decades. With cases spread over a large area, the sterile flies produced in Panama are not nearly enough to eradicate the parasite. The facility is operating at maximum capacity, but experts say they need 500 million a week to push screwworm flies back to the geographic boundary of the Darien Gap, a stretch of rainforest between Panama and Colombia. Enter NovaFly, a screwworm fly genetically engineered to produce only males. Once the male offspring are sterilized, they could be released to mate with wild female screwworm flies, which then lay unfertilized eggs. Wild female screwworm flies normally mate only once, so sterile male flies can make the screwworm population progressively decline. The USDA started using the technique in 1957 to fight the pest, which was eradicated from the U.S. in 1966 and eliminated later outbreaks. The NovaFly project is designed to boost the production of sterile flies. Currently, the Panama facility produces males and females. The females are useless in controlling the wild population, but there's no easy way to separate them, according to the USDA and entomologists. And in sports, best friends in every aspect. Arizona quarterback Noah Fifita, linebacker Dash Fifita, finally sharing the field. Arizona's coaches and players often mention bear down brotherhood when talking about the team's connection and continuity. Six football players at Arizona are literally living the brotherly lifestyle this season. Quarterback Noah Fifita and linebacker Dash Fifita, wide receiver Trey Spivey and cornerback Kingston Spivey, and offensive linemen Jake Griffin and Jackson Griffin. I think it's special when you take the field every day or a workout or a run or a practice, and you get to do it with your brother, said Arizona head coach Brent Brennan. I think that's pretty special. Don't know how many people get the opportunity to do that. That's magical. Brennan wasn't teammates with his younger brother, Brad Brennan, but they were often together in 2000 when Brent Brennan was an assistant coach under former Arizona head coach Dick Tomey, and Brad Brennan was a senior wide receiver for the Wildcats. The Brennan brothers also coached together at Oregon State. It was awesome. And I was a little bit older, so I never got to play with him. But I got to coach him for 1 year, and it was so much fun going on the field every day and being out there with him, Brent Brennan said. When we were at Oregon State, we coached the receivers together, and it was awesome. Sometimes we'd fight like brothers, and we got into these crazy disagreements. But at the same time, it's fun, because you know you trust him, and you're sharing this unique experience very few people get to have. Several brothers have been teammates at Arizona over the years. Most recently, offensive lineman Jonah Savaiya-Nea and defensive tackle Julian Savaiya-Nea were teammates for the 2024 season. Defensive ends Jalen Harris and Jason Harris were teammates under former head coach Jed Fish. Arguably the most well-known set of brothers to play at Arizona were tight end Rob Gronkowski and fullback Chris Gronkowski, before Rob Gronkowski went by Gronk. Jalen Carter became the highest-paid defensive tackle in NFL history after signing a four-year, $152 million contract extension that could increase to $160 million, ESPN reported on Tuesday. The deal, which reportedly includes $106 million guaranteed, will give Carter the distinction of being the highest paid player at his position, based on the contract's $38 million average annual value. The Eagles announced the extension through 2031 for Carter. However, they did not disclose financial terms. Per Sporttrack, Carter will earn a base salary of $1,145,000 and a roster bonus of $2,578,570 in 2026. The Eagles initially picked up Carter's fifth-year option in April. Carter, 25, was the ninth overall pick in the 2023 NFL draft. A Pro Bowl honoree each of the last 2 years, Carter helped the Eagles win Super Bowl 59. Carter has 108 tackles, 13 and a half sacks, 4 forced fumbles, 1 fumble recovery, and 13 passes defensed in 43 games with 27 starts. Last season, he logged 33 tackles, 3 sacks, and a career-best 7 passes defensed in 11 games, all starts, despite being slowed by shoulder injuries. 5-time Pro Bowl cornerback Denzel Ward and the Cleveland Browns have agreed on a 2-year, $62.2 million contract extension that includes $52.3 million guaranteed, ESPN and NFL Network reported on Tuesday. Ward, 29, had 2 years left on his five-year, $100.5 million contract extension signed in 2022, though it includes no further guaranteed money. The Browns' longest-tenured player, Ward, will earn $31.1 million annually, making him the highest-paid defensive back in league history for the second time in his career. His annual average salary, per ESPN, edges Ward ahead of Los Angeles Rams quarterback Trent McDuffie at $31 million, who was acquired in March from the Kansas City Chiefs and signed a four-year, $124 million extension. They are followed by the Indianapolis Colts' Sauce Gardner, $30.1 million, the Houston Texans' Derek Stingley Jr., $30 million, and the Carolina Panthers' J.C. Horn at $25 million, per ESPN. A native of Macedonia, Ohio, Ward was the fourth overall pick of the 2018 NFL draft. The Ohio State product has 361 career tackles, 18 interceptions, including 2 returned for touchdowns, 104 passes defensed, 4 forced fumbles, and 6 fumble recoveries in his 110 regular season games, with 107 starts for the Browns. Two of those recovered fumbles turned into touchdowns. He was elected to the Pro Bowl in 2018, 2021, 2023, 2024, and 2025, making his first public comments since being part of a head-on car accident earlier this month. Kyle Shanahan admitted fault on Tuesday for the collision that left him with serious injuries. The San Francisco 49ers head coach met with reporters in his office to give his side of the story after the initial news that leaked out over the weekend pinned the blame on the other driver. A California database that tracks car accidents listed the other driver at fault for making an illegal turn. But Shanahan, 46, said that wasn't accurate. "I hit her," Shanahan said. "I don't know why it was reported that way on the collision report database. The police report doesn't say that." The accident occurred July 14th in Palo Alto, and it did not become widely known, nor did the 49ers comment on it, until this past weekend in the lead-up to training camp. "I was going 20 miles an hour," Shanahan said. "I was not on my phone, but I dropped my phone and it was stuck in my seats. It's on my lap and it slid off, and I went down to look for it and my eyes off the road for 2 seconds. As I was coming up, the airbags hit me in the face. They broke my nose, and then they said the visor really gashed me. I took my eyes off the road looking for my phone and my car veered into someone. It's one of those roads where there's no forgiveness. When I hit her, the impact was just so... I'll never forget how violent it was." The Pittsburgh Steelers placed cornerback Jalen Ramsey on the physical unable to perform list after the 8-time Pro Bowler sustained a knee injury before training camp. Steelers general manager Omar Khan also announced Tuesday that offensive tackle Broderick Jones, with a neck injury, is cleared to begin practicing on Wednesday, but cornerback Dante Kent, foot injury, has also been placed on the PUP list. Khan stressed that the injury sustained by Ramsey during minicamp does not appear to be long-term and does not require surgery. "He's recovering," Khan said. "Just probably be a couple weeks if I had to guess on his return. We're just going to be smart about it. He's a pro. You guys know how hard he works." Ramsey, 31, was dealt to Pittsburgh last summer in a swap that sent safety Minkah Fitzpatrick back to Miami. He recorded 88 tackles, 3 sacks, and 1 interception in 17 games with the Steelers. Quarterback Baker Mayfield and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers are not close to a new contract as training camp is set to begin Wednesday, ESPN reported. Mayfield joined the team on a 1-year, $4 million deal ahead of the 2023 season as the Bucs try to fill the role of the retired Tom Brady. The team rewarded Mayfield's stellar effort with a 3-year, $100 million contract in March 2024. He is entering the final year on that deal, with his $33.33 million annual salary ranked 16th amongst NFL quarterbacks. ESPN reported that Mayfield is not afraid of playing out this season on his current deal or playing under the franchise tag in 2027. Mayfield, 31, earned back-to-back Pro Bowl nods in 2023 and 2024 while helping Tampa Bay capture consecutive division titles, though the team limped to an 8-9 record last season and missed the playoffs. In 8 NFL seasons with 4 teams, Mayfield has completed 63.5% of his passes for 28,525 yards, 197 touchdowns, and 101 interceptions in 123 games with 120 starts. And this has been a reading of the Arizona Daily Star. My name is Roland, your volunteer reader at Sun Sounds of Arizona, wishing you a pleasant day.